Two can keep a secret.
If one of us is dead.
I'm Pam.
And I'm Rhonda.
Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome, listeners, to this month's freestyle episode.
Freaky, freaky. It should be like a rap. Freaky, freaky freestyle.
You gonna write a rap for them then?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm not doing it. You're the writer. She wanted to be a journalist growing up, you guys.
I started college for journalism.
I know.
What are you doing?
What? I'm eating gummy bears.
You have had 3 hours since we were supposed to record to eat gummy bears.
What? Sorry, I had things that came up and then...
I like that you looked at the clock to try to prove me wrong, and you're like, oh, she's right.
Because that didn't seem like it should have been 3 hours.
It's been 3 hours. Okay, so let's get started. What are we talking about today?
Freestyle. We have freestyle episodes.
Yeah, I guess that's all there is to say. Okay, cool. So I'll get started.
Yeah, Pam's going first this week.
My case was a suggestion by Tabby. Remember Tabby?
Mm-hmm.
From school, from high school. She suggested this case, and it happens in Arkansas, so I was like, why not? Let's do it. And I've just further learned that police departments in Arkansas are not it. They're not it.
They don't train them smart over there.
West Memphis, boo. Little Rock, boo. So... yeah.
Wait, where is this? Oh, this...
Little Rock.
It's out of Little Rock?
Yeah.
Oh, they don't have an excuse then.
No.
See, because a lot of the problem is that you have small town police departments who...
Don't know how to handle.
Yeah, well, they just don't handle a lot of a specific kind of case. So when you present one to them, they don't have experienced officers there who have dealt with that before to teach the rookie officers. You know, so like nobody's experienced those things and they don't call in the state police, which is what they should do when they're in over their heads. But cops are typically type A personalities, and that means that we're a little prideful.
Rhonda's not type A.
No.
You're like the least type A person.
I have type A tendencies.
And I am the most type A person, which is why this is a struggle.
Okay, so tell us about your Little Rock case.
Okay, so this is about Ebby Jane Stefik. Have you heard of it, Ebby?
No, I don't think so.
So Ebby was born March 31st, 1997, to Lori and Peter Stefik in Little Rock, Arkansas. So Ebby, who is known to her friends and family as Ebby Jane, which is so cute.
That is really cute.
It's very Arkansas, but it's cute. She was just like any other teenager in October of 2015. She was a senior at Central High School and dreamed of becoming a cosmetologist and a real estate agent. And she was the type of girl that would make anybody smile, and she just never had an argument without making things right. She was just a nice girl.
Yeah.
In the first few weeks of her senior year, abrupt changes in Ebby's behavior caused some worry for her parents. The behavior was almost like it was a new person they were dealing with. She had switched schools in the beginning of the school year, and she moved from a private school to a public school.
Uh-oh.
And Ebby, she also wanted a little independence from her parents, so she decided to move out of her family's home and moved in with her brother, Trevor. She did move around, though, because in other places in the story, she like stays with a friend, she stays with her grandparents, but primarily she was staying with her older brother.
But how old was she?
She was 18. But she was still in high school. But
okay,
she was
18. Yeah, I got you.
Because I was you know that it doesn't matter I'm 18. It doesn't matter if I'm in high school. I'm 18. I can do what I want. Attitude is pretty much what she had going on.
Yeah. Which I... So you were 18 for, like, what, 6 months before graduation?
I turned 18 in November. So however long that would have been, yeah. About, yeah. Six months. 7 months. Early November.
Yeah. So I just... had a birthday, so it was like 3 weeks from the time I turned 18 until graduation, so like I didn't really, I mean, what would be the point?
But I also had a kid too, so I was already
at
17 doing what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I moved out though when my senior year. I had an apartment when I was 18. I moved out of my dad's house. So
I got one the summer that I turned 18. Well, no. Just kidding. What am I saying? No, I graduated high school, started college, lived in the dorms, and then the summer of my freshman year of college, I lived at home for not quite a month while I saved up money for rent and a deposit, and then I got an apartment. But I still moved out, shortly after because I lived, you know, on my own in college, but in the dorms, but still.
Yeah, so that's kind of what she was. She was just ready to be on her own.
I-N-D-E-P-E-N-T-E-N-T.
On October 20th of 2015, she had stayed at a friend's house from her old school, and she had sent a Snapchat message to Danielle West that said, "Hey, I know this is a lot to ask, but is there any way your mom would let me stay over for the night?" And West replied, "Sure, come on over. Dinner's almost ready." West later said that the two were always together anytime Ebby wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And she would often end up at West's home. She'd sometimes show up as late as midnight after having arguments with her parents. And okay. West told the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, "I think she just kind of thought of our house as a safe place."
Yeah.
So she would just go over there to, you know, get away from family.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the family had, like, super crazy issues. I think it was just that she wanted to be independent, but really she wasn't quite ready to be independent yet.
Yeah.
So and so they would butt heads.
Their foot down.
Yeah. I think it's probably more what it was than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Ebby had begun working at Foot Locker in the McCain Mall the summer before her senior year. And her parents say that that's when she started the job, that's when they really started to notice the changes in her behavior. So they're proud of her for getting the job and taking that step and that responsibility. But they said that that's what started to drive a wedge in the family. Mm-hmm. Ebby's stepfather, Michael Jernigan, said that's the dangerous part of raising kids. She had new friends, new behaviors. You're just sending her to the lion's den. And when Ebby got her first car, she told her mother, "You know, I have my own car. I should be able to come and go as I please." So this new independence opened up a new world for her. And her mom told Crime Watch Daily that she just didn't know the danger. Mm. So that's all that it was. Yeah, they were arguing, but it was I have a car that I pay for with my money from my job. I can do what I want, basically, is what I've gathered from all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, we've all been there. And it's the, if you're under my roof, you follow my rules. So she got out from under the roof, I'm sure, was the exact conversation that happened.
You know, I will say that my parents were pretty great as far as, like, when I turned 18, I finished school. And then, like, all of that summer before I moved into the dorm, they didn't really, like, I didn't have a curfew anymore, nothing like that. It was really just one of those, like, be respectful sort of things. So, basically,
probably because you were out of high school, though. I bet if you turned 18 earlier in the year, you might have butt heads a little.
Well, I don't know, because I was very involved in school. So I did sports and band and, like, I kept my academics up, stuff like that. So, and even then, like, the friends that I had that were already 18, like, their parents weren't letting them just do whatever. So I wouldn't have had anyone to go hang out with, even though they were 18. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I think my schedule still would have been exactly the same. But even though I still lived in their house after turning 18, it was just kind of like, hey, if you're going to be home after midnight, let us know so that we don't wait up for you.
Yeah.
So, like, it was still, I still did what I wanted, but it was, like, a respectful kind of thing. So, it was, like, a really good relationship.
Right. Well, on October 21st, Ebby's parents received a call from Central High School that Ebby was absent. And these truancy calls were something that they had been getting more and more frequently in the past few weeks.
Huh.
The following Friday, October 23rd, Ebby spent the evening at a small house party. West, her friend, didn't go to the party, I guess because it was people she didn't really know. I assume it was friends from her job and mm-hmm. her new school, because remember, West was from her old school.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, October 24th, Ebby sent a concerning text message to her friend Gage Fulton, and he actually read these text messages to Crime Watch Daily. He read the text messages to them. So the text said, "I was hanging with some dudes last night and I had sex with one of them and he fucking recording me, dude, like when I wasn't looking." So Ebby didn't tell Gage who it was that had recorded her, but she did tell him that she felt forced into it, like, altogether. And her last text message to him was, "I'm going to kill myself." So she didn't go kill herself. I think that was a dramatic, you know.
Right.
I'm going to kill myself. But yeah, not like a actual suicide threat. I think that they would try to twist it so that it seemed like an actual suicide threat. I don't think it was. I think it was just her being
like an FML kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
See, but you know what sucks is that since she was 18, that person can't be charged with making child porn.
Yeah.
For one. And for two, I don't think... So there are laws against posting sex videos of people without their knowledge and consent. So it started with the revenge porn law.
Yeah.
I don't think that law existed in 2015. I don't think there's anything that she could have done if they posted that video anywhere.
So let me tell you what happened, and then we'll kind of go back to that.
Okay.
Okay, so she had that text conversation with him. Again, she didn't tell him who. She just kind of told him what happened. But later that same night, she confided in her stepdad and told him, she texted him and told him that something had happened the night before at the party, and she told him that she had been raped by one of four men at the party. And she told him that she knew that the rape had been recorded on a cell phone of one of them, and he asked her if she wanted to report the rape, and she did. He was at dinner with her mom at the time. He didn't tell Lori, her mom, he didn't tell her that he had that conversation. He didn't want her to freak out like mm-hmm. a mom would. Mm-hmm. So he told her that after dinner, he would come to her grandparents' house where she was staying, and that they could discuss like what steps they wanted to take next. So kind of back to what you said, she wanted to go file charges for the rape is what she wanted to do. So I don't mm-hmm. know, like she wanted the recording, I'm sure, because she didn't want to get out because that would be embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
But she also says she felt forced into it, but she told the other guy she had sex, but she felt forced into it. So I don't even think that the recording would have necessarily had looked like a rape.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in the school. There was an issue with a young girl who had sent some nudes to a classmate on Snapchat. Mm-hmm. Mind you, I was working in the middle school at this point in time.
You're working where? Middle school?
In the middle school.
Oh, geez.
So middle schoolers.
And that is child pornography.
Yeah. What are they? 15?
No. Is the middle oldest? School? Aiden's middle school. 14 would be the oldest.
Okay. 14 would be the oldest. So it's like 12 to 14?
Yeah. Like 11. Yeah. 11 to 14.
Oof. I think she was an eighth grader. Anyway, so she the been kid.
Like 14.
Yeah. The kid screenshot it and then sent it to his buddies.
That's distribution of child pornography.
That it 100% is.
Mm-hmm.
So, to nip that in the bud, these poor kids, I think they thought they were going to die in prison, but...
You know what? They'll never send nudie pics again, maybe.
No. So, we wrote up an affidavit for their, like, requesting a warrant for their arrest for distribution of child porn. Mm-hmm. And they were like, but we're kids too, we're kids too. And we're like, it doesn't matter if you're a kid, you still took pictures, naked pictures of another child and distributed them. It doesn't matter what age you do that at, that's still distribution of child porn. They freaked the hell out. So I brought this information to our sex crimes detective at the time. And so she kind of filled me in on all of this, like on the back end. So I think the girl ended up not pressing charges because all the kids like deleted her pictures off their phone and they mm-hmm. swore they didn't send it to anybody else but the people who, you know, she had already talked to and yada, yada, yada. But they all got a lesson that day on not sending nudes.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Scare them straight. Anyway, so Ebby had spent the day with her grandparents. She had dinner with them, and then the three of them went out for frozen yogurt. They returned back to their house around 8 p.m., and Ebby told them that she needed to leave to go meet her stepfather, but made sure to tell them to not lock the door because she would be back to stay the night there later that night. However, her stepfather and her didn't have plans to meet up. Remember, I told you he was going to go there to mm-hmm. her grandparents' house. When he arrived at her grandparents' house, I don't know whose parents it was. I don't know if it was her mom's parents. I don't know. But whenever he arrived there, they told him that, like, she just went to go meet you. And so he was like, nope, that wasn't the plan. And so he was concerned, and he was like, I bet she went to go try to get that recording of her rape from those guys by herself.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so he and her grandmother, like, tried to call her multiple times with no luck. The next day, her brother, Trevor, tried to call her, and she answered the phone. And he said, like, where are you? And she told him that she was in her car parked in front of his house. So he hung up, he went outside, and she wasn't there. So he called her back again, and is like, where are you? You're not in front of my house. Where are you? Mm-hmm. And she told him that she was really fucked up, and that she was in her car. And he said, well, where is your car? And she says, I don't know, and hung up. And that was the last time anyone ever talked to Ebby.
But did police go back and, like, ping?
I'll tell you what the police didn't do.
Ping the last known location?
My next, like, five pages is what the police didn't do, so.
Oh, excellent, because that's what I want to hear.
So Trevor immediately called the police.
Yeah.
Because he was like, you need to be looking for this car. I don't know where my sister is. Like, something's wrong. But they told him that they needed to wait at least 12 hours before they could report her missing. Not 24, 12. And I think these are all made up rules. I get it. They don't want to waste resource and time looking for people who aren't really missing. But I need to know, how often does that happen that people report people missing that aren't really missing?
I don't know. I've been sent to work, like, missing juvenile cases. Like, it's after school, parents came home, kid was supposed to be there, and they're not. We usually disseminate that information throughout our department, and then we let the county know, hey, keep an eye out for this girl or boy, whoever. They're not really missing, though. It's always turned out to be a case of they went to boyfriend's house or girlfriend's house instead of going home, blah, blah, blah. So I don't think an official investigation was launched, because within a matter of, you know, like, before the night was over, in all of those cases that I can remember, oh, disregard, she came home, she was at so-and-so's house. I mean, that's usually it as far as, like, missing.
I feel like, I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea. But I feel like you have to wait 24 hours because, you know, they don't want to waste resources is just as bad as saying that, like, that women that report rapes are fake. Like, that doesn't happen. Like, women don't go that often and report. It happens, yes, but it doesn't happen as much as people act like it happens.
No, it doesn't. Yeah.
And I think this is the same thing. Like, I don't think people report their, at least other adults. Younger kids, maybe I get parents are going to freak out. But I feel like adults, they're not reporting them missing as often as they make it seem in all of these cases when they're like, you have to wait 24 hours.
Yeah. See, I don't know.
Because it's like the first 48. It's always the first 48. You just cut off that first half of those 48 hours of looking for somebody because of this stupid rule. There's just 12 hours, not 24, but still.
Yeah. I don't know that that's an official rule. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like that it's written somewhere that
I think it's just something that cops 24 hours. Do.
But there are some things that, like, I already know if I encounter a situation and someone needs to be arrested or I find such and such in their car or they've committed whatever offenses, I already know just through experience in dealing with prosecutors that, like, I'm not even going to bother bringing that to them. They're not going to try that. Or
that's a
misdemeanor traffic offense that's going to get dropped. So I'm just not going to charge it. Yeah, so there are some things that you just know how the prosecutor is going to handle it through giving them similar cases. So it may be one of those things that just
going
kind
off of what they have,
developed over time based off of, like, the level of severity, the evidence that you have up front to suggest foul play. So it may be things that, like, okay, if I bring this to my prosecutor and start requesting warrants right now, they're going to look at me and laugh.
Yeah.
So unless a certain amount of time has passed, they're not even going to take me seriously. So I don't know if it's so much like a rule that says 24 hours or if it's based off of the, like, severity
situation.
Situation.
Well, the family did wait the 12 hours. Like, to the minute, and then they're picking up the phone again and calling.
Oh, of course.
And She was listed as a runaway, so they weren't looking for her. They mm-hmm. didn't list her as missing. They listed her as a runaway. And no matter what the family did, they could not get that to change. It was mm-hmm. It was a runaway. So 3 days after Ebby had talked to Trevor, a security guard at Chalamont Park named Guy Hooper reported to police that there was an abandoned car in the lot next to the woods. 2 days later, on October 30th, police arrived to investigate the car and determined that it belonged to the missing 18-year-old. So 3 days after she went missing, and then 2 days after that is when they finally went mm-hmm. to look at the car. So 5 days before they went to investigate the car, it had been sitting there. The gas tank was empty, the battery was dead, the keys were in the ignition, and Ebby's phone, wallet, contact lenses, and makeup were all in the front seat.
That does not look good.
No. And the mom was like, what 18-year-old leaves their phone
in the car? None of them.
And then she's like, her contact lenses, she can't see without her contact lenses. And then she's like, she spent all of her money on makeup. Her makeup would not have been left in the car.
Yeah.
So.
Especially if she was going somewhere. Like, if she was just trying willingly to disappear and stay with somebody and hide, she's definitely
maybe leave
it.
The phone so that they can't find you, but you're taking your makeup and your contacts.
For sure.
And clothes. There's, like, clothes on the car and everything. So, when police finally interviewed Hooper several months later, he said that he had lost a video. Months later?
Months later.
He said that he had lost a video.
Sorry. They found the car 5 days later and waited months to interview people?
Mm-hmm.
How did none of this seem like, oh, you know, that's a little odd. Let me at least follow up.
She ran away.
You at least follow up. You have to confirm your theory.
By the time they interviewed him, he had said that he had video footage of Ebby on multiple different occasions in the park that just recorded from his car, like from his security. I don't know. I guess he had, you know, a dash cam. Mm-hmm. So he had, but he didn't have it anymore. Like, it's gone. They took too long. But he said that what it was that he had seen her multiple times leading up to the time her car was left there, because he's had to kick her out. Like, it's closing time to go.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew it was her. And he said that she was always there with some guys. There was one guy that was always there. And then the other guys just depended on who it was. And that the one guy that she was always there with, she was always hugging and kissing. And he described him as being 5'7 with dreads. So, on Crime Watch Daily, when they interviewed Hoover, they took some mugshots of these guys that had been arrested in Louisiana for sex trafficking. Mm-hmm. So they had those charges, and they had associations with Little Rock. So they pulled out the sheet of all these mugshots, and he was like, do you recognize any of these guys? They're like, if you do, great. If you don't, you don't. They're like, whatever, it's fine. Do you mm-hmm. recognize any of these guys? And he was like, these two. This one right here with the dreads is the one she was always with, and this one right here is another one. And the guy from Crime Watch Daily was like, how sure are you? And he was like 70%.
Mm.
Yeah. And so the guy from, on Crime Watch Daily, they take, I just want to say, at this time, this was the theory. She was missing and she had been taken in trafficking. That was the theory at this time when this interview happened with Crime Watch Daily.
Well, yeah, because this dude identified two suspected sex traffickers.
Well,
so that's
this was
what
even,
be.
I mean, that was the theory before then, because this, by the time they did that interview, I think it was like 2017. So it was like 2 years later.
Okay.
And she was still missing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the theory. She was taken into trafficking, which, yes, that's the theory you would come up with. So the Crime Watch Daily, it just blew up. I'm not going to say the guy's name, because there's no proof that he was involved in this case. They just slap his mugshot up and they're like, this dude. Said his name, everything.
I'm yeah.
like, yes, he's an awful guy, but you don't know that he was associated with this. But whatever, that's beside the point. So yeah, that's the guy that they are saying did it. The police, because the police aren't doing squat. They as in everybody else.
The
in
media
the
has just yeah. like, okay, we've done our own investigation and
yeah.
here it
this
is.
This was hard to piece together because of all of that. Because they're throwing names out there like that, and the cops are just like, meh, whatever. So, in the time that Ebby was missing, her mother was being taunted online. She was sent emails of conversations between men talking about buying Ebby. Someone created a Facebook account in Ebby's name and messaged Lori saying, "Hi, Mom, I'm okay, but I'm going to come home." Lori spent hours searching websites like Craigslist and Backpage to look for her daughter. I know everybody knows what Craigslist is, but Backpage is like a classified advertising website that people use for sex, like a sex marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it in plenty of the other cases similar to this. They're selling people on, I don't think it's around anymore. Anyway, so she just would go through just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of photos of women every day looking for a picture of Ebby being sold on these websites.
Yeah.
And they quickly lost faith in the Little Rock Police Department, which I can't say I blame them, and hired a private investigator named Monty Vickers. And he was hesitant to take the case, but after months of, like, trying to call the police to, like, see what he could do, and he just, with no response, he decided to open up his own investigation, and he signed a contract with the family for $1 and began tracking her movements.
Oh.
So his first step was looking into the men that Ebby said assaulted her. He was looking in the woods near their houses, you know, looking for a body, looking for evidence, anything. This is like years later again.
Mm-hmm.
And she had mentioned two of the individuals by name in the text conversation she had with her stepdad. He didn't, like, in all these interviews he's done, he didn't say their names because he didn't want to implicate them or jeopardize an investigation or anything. But the people who needed, the cops knew, the private investigator knew, they knew the names.
Yeah.
It was 8 months before the Little Rock police treated Ebby's disappearance as anything other than a runaway. They spoke to the men who were accused of assaulting her, but there was no search of her phone, of their phones, sorry, for the video of the assault. Which at that point, they dumped it anyway.
Yes, they'd have deleted that thing. Especially after, she's been missing for 8 months, quote unquote. So they're probably thinking, any day now, they're going to come question mm-hmm. us any day now.
Yeah. So Halo's Investigations, Inc., which is a private Mississippi firm that investigates cases of missing or trafficked children, began searching for Ebby as well. And they looked on Backpage as well as conducted a search of the park where her car was found. And they actually found out that Ebby had made two calls to police the night before she went missing. But police showed no record of the calls. Like, nothing. They don't have anything written down, like someone called about an assault. They don't have, like, there's nothing. But her phone records show that she called police twice.
Do police phone records show that they had been called?
I don't know. That's all that I could find on that.
Because if it doesn't,
I don't know
ring.
I don't know if she called 911 or if she just called, like, the non-emergency line. Like, I don't know what she called. But
because if it doesn't ring through all the way, then it may not show on their phone records.
Maybe not. I don't know. When Lori, Ebby's mom, tried to get the police to see where her phone had pinged from when she called her brother and when she called the police, they just, like, refused to do that. And so it was at this time that Lori began writing letters to the governor to ask for help in the search for her daughter. Finally, after months, federal investigators began working on the case. But by the time the FBI was involved, you know, there's evidence lost. I mean, Vickers turned over everything that he had, but, like, the video that the guys would have had, it's gone. Anything else is... The car's been gone through. I read somewhere that when the police found the car, they were going through it, and they left all the doors and everything open, and a rainstorm came in. So any DNA or anything that might have been in there, gone.
They just left it open?
It was open, and it's just storming like crazy.
They didn't...
Everything got wet.
They didn't just have not a it good... towed, is what you're telling me.
No. They, like, went through it on site, and it got rained all in.
Like, that night or something? Do you know? You may not know.
I don't know.
Okay, so here's the deal. If I search a car, person has illegal things in there, they get arrested, you can't leave the car there.
Yeah.
At that point, we have it rained.
I think it rained while they were there going through it on site. I think it just came down. And so everything's getting wet, everything's getting messed up. Whatever, because I did read that when they gave all of the clothes and stuff back to the family, they, like, everything was soaked. They had to go through everything. I don't know. So all of that's been ruined for any evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Vickers did give all of his research to the FBI, but, I mean, still, all of the good first-hand stuff is gone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that could be one of those things like, okay, a freak storm comes. You live in Florida where it rains randomly. I live in Mississippi where it rains randomly. So that may be one of those things that they just didn't think, like, oh, crap, we're getting wet. Or like, oh, we need to grab this evidence. Quick, hurry, it's raining. But you close the doors to the vehicle, people. Come on.
Yeah.
Like, that's, any lay person would do that.
The family ended up hiring another private investigator, TJ Ward, who has done many high-profile cases, only because their original one, he was getting old and he was having health issues. So that's the only reason he didn't do anything or wasn't lacking.
Yeah.
At one point in the investigation, a teen stumbled across some items in a remote area. The police told Ebby's family that they had found some clothes that belonged to a female, some handcuffs, and bones. And one of the items was a shoe, and the shoe looked like some shoes that she owned. However, the family was relieved whenever they found out that the discovery had nothing to do with Ebby, and it wasn't even human remains, it was animal remains.
Oh.
So that was, they had like a little bit of, I won't say hope, but at least they were hoping to get some closure on something, because mm-hmm. she's still missing at this point. In December of 2017, her parents went on Dr. Phil to get more attention for their missing daughter's case, and offered a reward of $50,000 for information leading in to Evie's discovery. Now we're going to jump ahead to May of 2018, so 5 months after the Dr. Phil. Around 10 a.m., police decided to search the park where Ebby's vehicle was found, just on a gut instinct. After
just randomly?
Well, so the case had been reassigned to a new lead detective.
Okay.
And that's kind of what sparked it.
Like
so
a
what
cold
I
case
saw
detective?
Said like a, yeah, what I saw said a gut instinct, but I think he came in at the end of like 17, beginning of 18. So I think this was, he was like, okay, I need to go search this area.
Okay.
So the last official search before that search had been in November of 2016. While performing the search, police discovered skeletal remains in a drainage pipe about 100 feet from where the car had been found years before.
Mm-hmm.
The remains were confirmed to be those of Ebby.
Oh.
After the body was discovered, Ebby's friend Kaylee and her mother Margie Foley were like enraged. Ebby had lived with them for a little while, just weeks before she went missing. Like I said, she was in and out of different people's homes.
Mm-hmm.
After Ebby went missing, they had met with detectives because she had lived there, and they decided that they should go out to the park where the car was found and look for Ebby. Margie had told THB 11, which is a Little Rock TV station, mm-hmm. that when she was out there, she was just hit with the smell of decomposition. And she told her daughter to go back to the car before she could smell it, and she called 911 and told dispatchers, like, I just came out of a meeting with Detective Williams in regards to a missing person named Ebby. I brought my daughter, who's her friend, and we started walking around, and I smell a body decomposing. And she's like, I just called his phone, talking about Detective Williams, I just called his phone, he hasn't called me back, could you please send somebody out here to investigate?
Yeah.
So PCSO then called Little Rock Police Department to relay the info. And she waited for more than 2 minutes before a supervisor came to the phone, and then the line went dead. So the dispatcher called again to speak to someone at LRPD and pass along the information. She's like, she said it smelled like something was decomposing, and she was worried that it may be related to the case. So that's all, you know, in a 911 recording.
Yeah. And when was that again?
When she first saw it was just a few weeks after she had gone missing, when this first phone call happened.
Okay. And nobody ever went and checked it out, is what you're about to tell me.
Well, so Foley called them at least 3 times, because they just weren't showing up.
Mm-hmm.
But by time that the body was actually found in 2018, like, all the records of her calls were gone. But mm-hmm. Foley claimed that it took over an hour for the police to arrive at the scene. And once they did show up, she was dismissed. And they told her that the park had been gone through with dogs, and that the dogs would have picked up on it, and that she must be smelling an animal. And she told the reporters for the television station, she said, I'm very angry. I'm very angry for Ebby. She didn't deserve to lay down there like that. And Kaylee Foley, her daughter, said, it's just hard to think. Someone you know, or someone you were best friends with, went missing, and then turns out they were where you thought they were the whole time. So the theory before her body was found was that she was trafficked, which we talked about. And that is why everyone was searching, you know, Backpage and Craigslist all the time. Now the most popular theory is that when she went to try to get the videotape of the rape, the men killed her to keep her from going to police. One of the private investigators that the family had hired discovered that she had been texting the four men that night and to tell them that she was going to go to police. So there is a motive for that.
Mm-hmm.
And like we've discussed, this case was botched from the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, it took a new team and a detective for the body to be found 100 feet from where the car was found.
Right. I'm just still reeling over the fact that she was like a stone's throw from her car.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, I understand that they got poured on, whatever. You don't want to search in the rain. I get it. Because those uniforms, once you get wet, you stay wet. But you have to go back out there afterwards because you didn't get to finish your search. Like, finish doing your job before you move on.
I just don't know how they did. Especially when someone's like, I can smell something here. You don't think they would at least humor the lady and take a look around?
Right, just to be thorough. Because I'm going to tell you right now, there are points in your day, or if you're working night shift, where it's dead. There's nothing happening. You can be like, oh, you know what? We need to follow up on this lead.
Yeah.
Because that's what you do with that dead time. You're assigned leads to follow up on.
They didn't do it. Little Rock Police Department Cold Case Detective Tommy Hudson took over the case in 2018. The family completely credits Hudson for finding Ebby's body. Because like I said, he took over and that's when they went out there and did that search. In an interview with Fox 16 News in 2018, Hudson said, "When I got the case, there were things that weren't done that should have been done from the front end." He explained that things like interviewing key witnesses, checking surveillance footage at a nearby Walmart, and a social media search had not been done. He said, "We always look at that. Why it wasn't done the first time? I can't answer that. I can tell you it's been done now." So in 2021, Hudson resigned and moved to the North Little Rock Department. Ebby's stepfather said, "Without Tommy, we wouldn't have the investigation. We wouldn't have a case." He said she just would be in a file somewhere. And her mother followed up with, "He came in and saved the day" on Ebby's case.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just going to tell you a little bit more about Ebby. Her mother had said that in her obituary, she said her favorite place in the world was the beach. She loved the ocean and collecting seashells. Her mother recalled her first breath stating, "I knew when she took a breath, her first breath, that we would be close and that she would be a very special young lady." Sometimes a mother just knows what their child can't say, and we're like that. The beach was one of her favorite places, and I will always feel as if she's there with me. She was funny. She would not let you leave a room without making you laugh, and I would give anything to hear her laugh again, to laugh with her again.
Mm-hmm.
In 2021, Lori told reporters, "I am at peace. I don't have to have an end to this story." She said, "I will live with that. I do want justice. I don't want to lose sleep at night not having that justice." And that's where we are. There are no new updates.
So no leads.
I think this could have very well been solved had the police in the beginning done what they were supposed to do.
There's definitely a better chance of it, for sure.
Yeah. But no, there's no new leads. I don't know. I mean, I assume the new detective followed up with the four men. Like I said, that video's long gone.
Yeah.
But, and her body, I mean, 2 years, there wouldn't have been really anything to go off of with that when they found it. Not 2 years, 3 years. It was 3 years since she disappeared that they found her body.
Yeah, anything on the, if they would have gotten lucky and weather hadn't destroyed the body in the first place, 3 years later, her bones have been picked clean by animals, yeah. Ants.
Well, and she was in a drainage pipe, too. So, you know, I mean, there's
the
just
water.
It's wet. Yeah, just water. So there's, I'm sure there was nothing they could go off of with that. Had they found it, you know, 5 days after she went missing, there would have been something. But, yeah.
I just can't. Like, I know Little Rock is a pretty large department. They've got a lot of stuff going on. So I know that things may not get followed up on quickly, you know, but you got to follow up at some point. Like, you've got to do your job, and there's no point in half-assing it.
So, Rhonda, what do you think happened to Ebby? Ebby Jane.
How do I think she died?
Mm-hmm.
I think if
she was raped, like she said, or accosted into having sex with whoever.
Sorry, I didn't move my microphone in front of my face. They probably were, like, harassing her because they knew, like, if she did try to go get the video from them and they said no, well, okay, I'm going to the police. They probably freaked the hell out and, like, confronted her, and that's who killed her.
Possibly. I just wonder, though, since they did, from what it seems like, the new detective did interview them, so maybe there's just not enough for an arrest.
Well, I mean,
without the video or anything, there's probably not enough for an arrest.
Years later, that's mm-hmm. no surprise.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, I think that's probably what happened. Who do you think is responsible for her death?
I think the same thing.
Same thing? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You would think the same thing because that's what we do.
It is kind of weird, though. It is weird that her car and everything was found in this place where she had been spotted with all of these other guys other times.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if those other guys are the ones that were involved in the alleged rape. We don't know if it's the same guys or different guys.
Right, yeah. Well, she could have been meeting them there because she met them there before. And mm-hmm. she was probably, if you don't meet me here and talk to me, I'm going to go to the police. So maybe they went there to talk her down. And then when they couldn't, they killed her. Because if she's known to meet people there.
Yeah.
Then it wasn't strange to find her car there. It's just strange that she wasn't in it.
So. I don't know. Maybe we'll find out one day.
I don't know. Did they say what was her official cause of death? Was it like blunt force or was the body too far?
Say.
They couldn't tell.
It's too decomposed.
I didn't think I remembered you saying that, but okay. So my case. I feel like I say this every time.
It's a doozy.
But it's a doozy. I think this time you're going to agree, though.
Well, let's hear it.
Well, do you remember how wild of a ride my stalking case was?
No.
You don't?
I can't remember. No.
Remember, she was like mailing stuff to his work and she was making stuff up and she kept those journals and like.
Yes, yeah, I remember.
Okay, so this is on par with the roller coaster level that case was.
You know, that's very, your stalking case was very Gone Girl-esque.
It's really funny that you should say that. And before
is
I give too much
gone
away.
Is Gone Girl-esque?
No, yes, no, maybe. I don't know. I'm just going to get into it and you decide.
Okay. Can I just say, never mind, I don't want to say it. Never mind.
Well, now you know I want to hear it.
I also say Brad Pitt looks like someone who would be accused of killing his wife.
I don't know. I always thought he was really hot.
I don't know if it's just from that movie, because when I watch that movie, I'm like, yeah, he looks like the dude that would kill his wife and then be like straight face in front of the camera, even though he didn't kill her.
Yeah.
But still, they like that was good casting.
I always thought he was super handsome, especially in Daredevil.
Not handsome. I don't know.
And I think it was like the whole wounded bird, plus he has like battle scars. And, you know, women always think scars are sexy. Don't look at me like that. They are.
Okay.
All right. Diving in. On November 2nd, 2016, in small town Redding, California. Okay. My articles and stuff called it small town. I think we have different ideas on what constitutes a small town.
How big is it?
You'll see in a minute. So in small town, Redding, California, Keith Papini came home from work and became concerned after discovering that Sherry, his wife, and their two children were nowhere on the premises. Given that Sherry's car was in the driveway, he assumed that maybe they had gone for a walk. And it was a lovely day outside, so this wasn't out of the question. But after some time had passed, he realized it was pretty implausible that they were still out for a walk, and he began to panic a little. He called the daycare his children attended and was told they hadn't been picked up yet. Cue the worry sweats and his pounding chest.
Right, they didn't. Why didn't they call?
I don't know. They like probably
how late
had.
Was it?
It was before 6 o'clock, so they probably just have that pickup time, and so they won't call until you're later than the pickup time. And at this point, I don't think it was.
These places will charge you by the minute, too.
They really do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like $100 every 10 minutes or something.
I don't know. Something crazy.
Yeah. Don't be late.
Reason number 87 to not have children.
To not have kids. The late fees. Let's not even mention the just general cost of daycare.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so now he's even more worried, and he decides to ping Sherry's phone using the Find My iPhone app. It was found at the intersection of Sunrise Drive and Old Oregon Trail, which was basically at the end of their driveway. So, unable to shake the feeling that something was off, Keith decided to meet his wife at that location where her phone pinged. And, you know, it's just when he got there, there was no Sherry in sight. But what he did find would make his heart drop. He found her phone connected to a set of headphones that had been wound up and were lying on the ground. And wrapped up inside the headphones was a very large chunk of Sherry's unmistakable bright blonde hair.
Oh, that's not good.
No. So when Keith picked up the phone, it was playing Everything by Michael Bublé, which happened to be their wedding song.
Bublé.
Bublé. I never say it right the first time, so I'm really surprised I just did there. But this was, like, pretty foreboding for him, you know, so you gotta imagine, like, where this puts his headspace. So at 5:51 p.m., Keith placed a call to 911, and he said, "I just got home from work, and my wife wasn't there, which is unusual, and my kids should have been there by now from, like, daycare, so I was like, oh, maybe she went on a walk." And then, of course, he gives them the rundown of, you know, what he did next and where he found her phone and the hair and yada yada. And so the dispatcher sends a couple of deputies over to the Papini residence.
Papini?
I know. It's a fun one to say.
Had you said his name yet?
Keith. Keith Papini.
Papini.
I watched an episode of Dateline to get the majority of my information for this episode. And on the show, Keith Morissette, our old boy Keith Morissette, interviews Sergeant Kyle Wallace and Captain Brian Jackson, who were the Shasta County Sheriff's detectives assigned to this case. And as the detectives looked into the case, they consider every possible angle. So, of course, they have to look into the husband. Because what do we say?
It's always the husband.
So, of course, you know, they start looking into the Papini family dynamics. And from the outside looking in, Sherry was the girl next door. She had a family life that was enviable by all standards. And of course, Dateline has this like mirage of pictures that they kept showing where this petite little Sherry and her super handsome husband are posing together, and there are like several pictures of them pushing their kids on the swings and posing for all these professional pictures, which I tell you right now, they had 1,000 of them made because they... like, legitimately 30 professional pictures kept sweeping by the freaking TV. Anyway, they cleared Keith pretty quickly as he had been working at Best Buy the whole day. So they started asking friends and family, you know, what their insight into the Papini home was. And specifically, who is Sherry Papini as a whole? To no surprise, everyone doted on the couple and called Sherry a supermom. By all accounts, she loved her children and husband and would have to be out of her mind to willingly leave her family behind. She had lived her whole life in the same town, as had Keith, so the pair had known each other since childhood.
Sounds awful.
I mean, Dane has lived in the same town his entire life.
It sounds awful.
When alas they got together and decided to get married, Sherry gushed about the ordeal in her blog, stating, "I love him more and more every day," and writing about how excited she was to marry Keith. They married in October of 2009. Before police could even think about starting an investigation, all of Reading had come together to make flyers and yard signs that listed Sherry Papini with one of these picture-perfect pictures of her. Picture-perfect pictures. And then it lists out last seen near Old Oregon Trail, missing since 11-2-06, Sex, female, age 34, eyes blue, height 5'2", weight 105. Like I said, she was tiny. And then there's like a paragraph under all of that that basically sums up, or basically to sum it up, says went missing on an afternoon jog.
If I ever go missing, Rhonda, I need you to make sure that my weight is not posted on my missing flyer. Just make sure it's not on the missing flyer. Or lie. Like, drop me like 30 pounds. Pamela Jacobson,
135 is what I was going to say.
135. That's more than 30. I'll take it.
5'6", 135.
There you go.
137 after cheeseburger. Someone will see me and be like,
no, there's no way that's her.
Okay. So almost immediately, her case goes viral. The case was quickly spread across social media, and with a matter of minutes, it would seem, local and the national news stations picked it up.
What year was this again?
2016.
Oh, okay.
A GoFundMe was set up to help Keith through this trying time, and again, in no time at all, it had raised a total of $49,070.
Woo, missing white woman syndrome.
Yes. Redding, California had about 180,000 residents in 2016.
180,000?
Yes, and they kept calling it a small town.
Absolutely not.
A small town, 180,000 residents. Okay, no. The last apartment.
Brooklyn had 1,300 when I lived there.
Yes.
The 1,300. 1,300.
The last apartment I worked at, let me Google it because I don't want to give the wrong numbers, but it had.
I used to have a coworker who had only lived in New York City, Miami, and then where we live now. And I told him one time that my hometown, when I was younger, had a population of 1,300. He was like, 1,300. I was like, yeah. He's like, 13,000? I'm like, 1,300. And he goes,
1,300.
He goes, I've been in clubs that hold more people than that.
Oh, God.
And so whenever I went back home to visit, I took a picture of the population sign, which at the time was like probably 16. And I texted to him. He was like, oh, my God, that's insane. He's like, I can't even imagine that.
Okay, the last apartment I worked for, the population for that city is 5,600 people. So yeah, that is small town. Brooklyn, where we went to school together, is small town. 180,000 people.
That's small town.
Yes, it's not small town. So, I mean, even the county I live in, it's significantly larger than 5,600, but it's still small. So the community I live in is small. I'm like, you people with your 180,000. I about crapped a brick when I read that. Rolled my eyes. Anyway, so it had about 180,000 residents in 2016, and it would seem like every last one of them came out to help search for Sherry. One Redding resident described the search, saying that it went like late into the night on many evenings. And that as she looked up ahead of her, all of the flashlights from the searchers reminded her of the night sky. There were little dots of light as far out as she could see. They said like a couple thousand people showed up to help search for her.
Only a couple thousand out of 180?
Right. That's a lot of people, though, that are just like, meh, I don't have anything else to do.
A couple thousand still bigger than Brooklyn, Arkansas.
That's right. So meanwhile, police are closely examining as much as they could about Sherry's life, painstakingly reviewing every single detail. For example, they had scoured through every contact in her phone and had actually found that two of them had been listed under women's names and actually belonged to men.
Ooh, that's suspicious.
That's questionable for sure. So they talked to some ex-boyfriends, and Sherry had an ex-husband. And of course they asked Keith if he would take a polygraph. Even though he did have an alibi. Well, he quickly volunteered, stating that he wanted to get himself cleared so that they could refocus their efforts elsewhere.
You're damned if you do, damned if you don't with that one.
Yeah, I guess
the only time that you get is if you pass it.
Right. Like,
then it's fine. But even then, they might not even say anything that you passed it.
Right. Well, I think he was a little more confident because he knew, one, he had an alibi, two, he knew he wasn't responsible. So I don't think they were polygraphing him to confirm his alibi. I think they were trying to question him and see if he knew anything else about what had happened to her. Because even though he was at work, he could have been in on something, you know?
Yeah.
Police were working 24 hours a day on this case. They even went all the way to Michigan to speak with one of Sherry's exes because he had recently visited California. But that didn't turn up much information. Of course, he had an alibi. People started to theorize that maybe Sherry walked away from her life, but police quickly extinguished that theory with a press conference outlining the circumstances of Sherry's disappearance. The sheriff said that she was missing and at risk, quote unquote. Keith ended up hiring a private investigator, Cody Selfin, to help shuffle through the mountain of tips that were coming into the sheriff's office. Selfin said that he went through and basically eliminated all the bogus tips. So those from psychics, people who saw stuff in their dreams, etc. And basically, he said that all kinds of interesting people will come out of the woodwork for cases like this. So most of the stuff that they got was bogus. The entire community was panicked. Apparently, Redding has a plethora of joggers because Dateline kept like flashing over scenes of people running and interviewed several people that talked about how terrified they were to even step outside. I dramatize a little bit, but so did Dateline. Well, the community had also drawn
that's why you shouldn't jog. That's why I don't jog.
Oh, so you don't get kidnapped?
Yeah.
I mean, what if they steal you while you're walking the dogs? Reason. You'll have both arms full with leashes, and they'll just, like, pull you into
the
van. You
know I don't walk those two dogs. Could you imagine if I walk them together? There's no way. I do not walk those dogs together.
You could do it.
You can. It's just they want, when they're out there together, they want to wrestle.
Yeah.
Which is not good when there's leashes involved.
They need more time off leash, Mom.
They run away.
I'd say fence them, but I know how that works with those two.
They get out and then they run away.
Coda's an escape artist.
Yes.
Okay, so the community had also drawn a parallel between Sherry's disappearance and another that had occurred under very similar circumstances 20 plus years earlier. And this was the disappearance of Tara Smith, who went missing August 22nd of 1998. So Tara had been grounded for sneaking out of the house one night and was stuck at home for the afternoon until she was supposed to report to work at her family's business. She had told her sister that she was going out for a jog, and then her sister left for a birthday party, not realizing that Tara was never going to return home. Her parents, Terry and Marilyn, were at first really annoyed with their daughter when she didn't show up for her shift at the Oasis Fun Center. That sounds... Oasis Fun Center.
What is it?
It's just like an arcade, I think. But that's the business that her family owned. So the Smiths call Kyra, which is Tara's sister, away from the birthday party to come cover Tara's shift. So you have Terry, Marilyn, Kyra, Tara... And there was another sister. I don't remember her name, though. But at first, the Smiths had assumed that maybe Tara had gone to a friend or an ex-boyfriend's house. And it wasn't until they returned Marilyn's calls that the couple had really started to worry. Tara's friend told Marilyn, "I think she was having an inappropriate relationship with Troy Zink." And it was at that point that a ton of red flags went up. And the Smiths contacted police. Terry and Marilyn end up going over to Zink's house that very night to confront him. It was around 9 p.m. and his wife sent the Smiths away, stating that Troy was not home. So, 29-year-old Troy Zink had been Tara's Taekwondo instructor. The family knew that she idolized Zink, but they had no clue that the pair was in any sort of relationship. So Zink ends up calling the Smiths back at around 11 p.m. that night, and the story he told them is the one that he stuck to throughout the entire investigation into Tara's disappearance. He said that he had picked Tara up that afternoon, but that he had dropped her off a few miles from the house sometime before she was supposed to go to work that evening. Then
how old is Tara again?
Tara is 16.
That's not allowed.
No.
You cannot pick her up and take her places.
No. So he said that he never had a relationship with her, which is why no charges were ever pressed, because they couldn't confirm that there was actually a relationship.
I don't care. You can't take her places.
No. Definitely not without parental
29?
Consent.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
29?
29.
Even with parental consent, there's no reason for a 29-year-old man that is not related to you to be driving a 16-year-old girl
like
around.
A mentor to her, Pam. He's her Taekwondo instructor.
That's not how it works.
Yes, it is.
No.
He said that he dropped her off in time for work, and then he went to a nearby hill called Hang Glider Hill, and then he told the Smiths that he had been up there for the next 5 hours praying. And then that was it. That was a whole story.
That's that's not an alibi. That's like I was at home sleeping.
No, he was out there praying. Nobody questions you when you say you're praying. You praying. You are praying.
I'm questioning him.
But yeah, that was it. There were no more leads, and no matter how hard they pushed, police could not get Troy to say anything else about his involvement with Tara. So the Smiths took things into their own hands and decided to rifle through Tara's belongings. And that's when they found a letter that Tara had written to Zink. Based on what they read in the letter, Tara's parents believe that she had been planning, that she had in fact been in a relationship with him, and that she had been planning on ending it. And they thought that maybe she had planned on like either handing him the letter or was going to mail it, but then decided to end their relationship in person instead. During the investigation, police found several old sporting rifles and shotguns that had been stored in the attic of Zink's Taekwondo studio. And given that he was a convicted felon, he was not allowed to have firearms on his property. I don't know what he was convicted of. He was claiming that they belonged to his father, from whom he was renting the space for his Taekwondo studio.
He was convicted for child molestation.
Good chance. And if you look at him, he looks like someone who would have a relationship with a child. You can't have a relationship with a child for raping children.
Who would rape a child?
Raping, fondling, molesting. You name it. Child porn. I'm surprised I didn't find child porn. Anyway, so Tara Smith was never found, and the investigation fizzled out relatively quickly. Police had a strong suspicion that Troy Zink was responsible for Tara's disappearance, though they were unable to pursue charges due to lack of evidence. They did, however, get Troy convicted for...
Evidence, schmevidence. Put him in jail.
I mean, we, contrary to popular belief, do not fabricate that stuff, so... They did, however, get Troy convicted for possession of a firearm by a felon in June of 1999, where he was sentenced to 4 years. So, Keith Morissette, in all of his wisdom, asked the detectives involved in Sherry's case if they considered a link between the two cases. They said it was definitely something they looked into, but after speaking with Zink, who was able to provide an alibi, they were forced to drop that theory. So there was nothing to corroborate it. So this brings us to November 24th of 2016, just 3 weeks after Sherry Papini went missing. It was 4:30 a.m., and Allison Sutton is driving down County Road 17 near Interstate 5 in Yolo County.
Yolo!
Yolo!
How's it spelled?
Y-O-L-O, Yolo.
Nice. I bet they had a heyday when Yolo got popular.
Oh, yeah. So out of nowhere, Allison sees a distraught woman running down the side of the road, like popping in and out of 70 plus mile per hour traffic. And lo and behold, this would turn out to be none other than Sherry Papini, who was found approximately 150 miles south of where she had disappeared from. Allison, of course, calls 911, and then shortly after, Sergeant Wallace received a phone call from Keith, who was very excitedly telling him that Sherry had been located And then, like, 5 seconds later, he receives a call from the sheriff's office detailing the same information. So then him and Captain Jackson respond to the side of Interstate 5, where they found a very battered-looking Sherry.
They're going to say Captain Jack.
Captain Jackson. She had been found with zip ties around both wrists that had been secured to a chain that was around her waist. Her long blonde hair had been chopped off, and she looked like she hadn't eaten a proper meal in weeks. There was bruising all over Sherry's body that was in various stages of healing, but none of this compared to the wound that she had on her back, which proved to be a brand that was burned into her right shoulder.
Ugh.
The citizens of Reading woke up on Thanksgiving morning to the news that Sherry had been found, and the entire city celebrated their holiday with one more thing to be thankful for.
What was her brand?
You'll find out in a minute.
I want to know now.
You'll find out in a minute. Of course, police wanted to interview Sherry, but she was reluctant to speak with them. They ended up asking Keith to interview his wife about the incident while they coached him on what questions to ask her. She was not talking to them at all. Sherry said that she was out for a run when an SUV drove past her and then turns around and, like, burp, stops their vehicle right in her path. Then two Hispanic
females... There's a creepy white van that drives past me every morning when I'm walking the dogs. And I try not... David says that I'm being... What's the word? Like, stereotyping them or profiling. Because it's a creepy white van. And they clearly live back there because no one's back there unless they live back there.
Yeah, if you see it regularly...
all the time. But every time I see it, I'm like, Coda. Wait.
They're either stalking you or they live back there. So you just...
They definitely live back there.
So this SUV stops right in front of her. Two Hispanic females wearing masks get out of the vehicle, wielding guns, and order her into the car. And then they drive her to an unknown location. A very terrified Sherry was unable to say much more than that at the time. Like, that was all the details she was going to give. But in subsequent interviews, she did give some new details about her abductions. Her abduction. She told police that she was instructed by her captors to leave her phone behind. So she had intentionally pulled out a chunk of her hair to leave with her phone because she knew that this would send a message to Keith that something had happened to her. She knew he would worry.
I mean, I think just her phone laying on the ground would be enough of a...
Probably, especially given that she was supposed to pick their kids up from daycare and didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't just...
I'm not ripping my hair out. Unnecessarily ripping my hair out.
Yeah. She didn't know much about her time in the car with her captors because they had put a bag over her head. But since it was a sunny day, she was able to see through the bag just a little bit. Just enough to describe having been driven through an area that was, like, had a lot of trees. And she said they drove for a long time until the temperature got colder and then detailed a rural, almost mountainous area. They turned off a paved road onto a dirt driveway where they had to cross through a gated area. And then she went up some stairs to get into the residence where she was placed in a small room. She then said that her captors made her change clothes, but allowed her to keep on her own underwear. Then one of the women, who was particularly cruel, cut off her long blonde hair and said that she was going to send it to Sherry's mother. She was also allowed to shower, but had been given a 5-gallon bucket filled with cat litter that she was supposed to use the bathroom in. She had lost a ton of weight because she was only allowed to eat once a day. And she said they fed her rice or tortillas, and sometimes she got fruit such as an apple or a banana. Sherry said that she attempted to escape at one point by ripping some boards off of a window, but she was caught, and as a punishment, her captors started keeping her in a closet where she was chained to a metal pole. Her captors would frequently remove her from the closet to administer beatings, and at one point shackled her to a coffee table where they branded her shoulder. She continued by describing the pain the searing noises and the smell of her burning flesh to police.
Ugh.
She painted quite the horrific picture. She told police that she was terrified to speak with them at first because the women who abducted her had said that the man they were planning on selling her to was a police officer.
Ah, convenient.
Likely story, right?
I mean, yeah.
So the investigating detectives told Keith Morissette that this bit of information struck them as like extremely odd, but they of course had to start an investigation to look into these allegations. So now you have a parallel investigation into the local police department and sheriff's department.
Yeah.
Sherry finished detailing the horrors of her captivity by telling police that she heard her captors arguing in Spanish one day until, like, boom, she hears a gunshot, and then only one of the women came into the closet where she was being held, put a pillowcase over her head, and then led her outside into a car. After an unknown amount of time in the vehicle, she was dumped on the side of the road. Despite having been beaten, bruised, and branded, Sherry was adamant that not once during her missing 3 weeks had she ever been raped. But naturally, samples were taken along with Sherry's clothes from the night she was found, and they were sent off to the crime lab for testing. Sherry, of course, had been given the investigators' contact information so that she could reach out to them anytime she recalled details of her time in captivity. So she reached out to them one night and was able to describe to them the table that she was chained to while she was branded. And armed with this information, Keith scoured the internet until he found a table that resembled the one Sherry was describing. Keith, bless his heart, was doing everything he could to provide justice for his wife. In the meantime, Sherry was struggling to return to her normal life. She had started seeing a counselor and, other than their visit, rarely left the house. Although she and Keith did join the Smiths for dinner one evening, for obvious reasons, they had taken a particular interest in Sherry's disappearance, and they felt a strange connection to her and were super relieved when she was found.
So they didn't have like a relationship with them beforehand?
Not really. I think they kind of lived in the same community, shopped at the same grocery store kind of thing. And Sherry had actually graduated from the same high school as their daughter at around the same time, if I remember right. But like, no, they didn't have a connection with them really before that. But they described Sherry as being very reserved, and Marilyn said that she seemed uncomfortable even existing. Like, just being out in the world made her uncomfortable.
Yeah.
They then described a scenario in which Sherry needed to use the restroom, and she ended up asking Keith to come along and guard the door for her. Like, she just couldn't go anywhere by herself. At another point during their dinner, a ring had fallen off one of her fingers, and she apologized, mumbling something about how she had lost so much weight that even her jewelry had been falling off of her. So I tell you all of this as an example of how different life had become for Sherry. Naturally, many of the locals had doubts about the way that things had unfolded, and many of them thought it was strange that as quickly as Sherry had disappeared, she had miraculously been returned, and on Thanksgiving morning of all days.
You know what else is strange? But you haven't told me what the branding was yet.
You'll find out in a minute.
You said that a minute ago.
I said that like 2 pages
Multiple minutes ago.
But you'll find out. It's in here, I swear. So one reporter, Kelly Sands, commented on how eager the community was to hear answers from Sherry herself. But of course, she refused to speak with anyone. And she didn't really speak with the press at all throughout her entire investigation. Naturally, the small town rumor mill began to turn. Police ignored much of what was said until information came to light that brought them back to a police report they had previously read but discounted and sat to the side. This report outlined a situation in which Sherry had broken into her own sister's house And it also stated that she had also stolen money from her father's checking account without his permission. Had taken money without his permission. So she stole it. But there was also another report from 2003 that said that...
2003?
That said that a then 21-year-old Sherry had been harming herself and was telling other people that her mother was responsible for it. So her mother goes and files a police report in case Sherry ended up going to the police about her injuries. Police, of course, make mental notes of these incidents, but as they did not seem to relate directly to the kidnapping, they again sat this information to the side, just filed it away for a later date.
It just seems like a lot of faking things.
Just a very dramatic woman, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. One individual who took a particular interest in the case, Liz Thompson, who was a former homicide unit supervisor from Albuquerque, she pointed out some of the obvious discrepancies in Sherry's story. So she tells Keith,
you know what
Morissette,
happened in Albuquerque? High School Musical.
Oh, God. You would remember that.
Yeah, duh.
So, oh yeah, Pam has an obsession with Zac Efron. So if you're not aware, he's in High School Musical. Mm-hmm. That's where we...
Everybody knows that.
That's where you fell in love with him for the first time. Was that the first thing he was in?
Yeah, you say that. We say it now, it's weird.
Yeah, but back then, but like, we were like...
We were the right age then.
Yeah, we were like 14, so you can love him back then.
What year did High School Musical come out?
I don't know. That's why I just asked you.
High School Musical. 2006. So...
Yeah, so in 06, we were like 14. How old was he in 06?
Hold on, I can tell you. It doesn't matter, because he's fine now.
Yes, he
is. Zac Efron. Age... In High School Musical.
He's getting a little gray in his hair and beard, and I'm about it.
Did you see the TikTok I sent you about, they were like interviewing him, and they're like, people are freaking out about you being old enough to be a dad in your upcoming movie. And then she's like, Zach Daddy, you're giving a new definition to the word zaddy. And he goes, what does zaddy mean? Which I didn't know what zaddy meant. But she was like, it's a hot dad. And he's like, oh. He was like, huh, oh, well.
I mean, if the shoe fit.
Hold on. I'm trying to find out how old he was. Hold on.
You should have his birthday memorized if he's your boyfriend.
I don't. He's 34 now, so he would have been 18.
Oh, yeah. We could totally. Yeah.
I mean, 18 and 14 is kind of not good. But 34 and 30, that's fine.
At least we could have both been in high school at the same time at that point. So then Romeo and Juliet law would apply. It's doable.
I'm glad we're figuring out how we could have worked around being with Zac Efron.
Some guy that we'll never even meet.
We would have been older than that, though, because that was 16 years. No, yeah, 14. Math. Math is hard.
Come on, lady.
Okay. Anyway, sorry.
So Liz Thompson, who did homicide investigation things in Albuquerque, she reviewed the court documents for this case, and she said that a few things stuck out to her pretty quickly. She found it odd that after being accosted by two individuals en masse who were pointing guns at Sherry, that she would have the presence of mind to pull out her own hair to leave as a clue. So you've got all this stuff going on, and
some
she's like,
"People do.
Oh, I'm gonna pull my hair out and leave it."
Look at my girl in our Survivor episode.
Yeah.
She's being raped and she's ripping out her fingernails to leave behind.
I imagine that process happened a lot more slowly than this, unfortunately.
Maybe, but some people do have that. I don't have that.
Oh, girl, I've got that, like, pre-paranoid, how am I gonna, you know. I may die, but I'm telling you, they're gonna catch you.
My brain stops working and I forget everything I know in emergency situations, so I do not have that.
Freeze mode?
Yeah. Pretty much.
You guys don't ever get in a shootout with Pam as your backup because she will be useless.
Yeah, my brain just shuts down.
At one point, Sherry had also detailed that after being thrown into an SUV, her captors had placed zip ties on her restraining her hands behind her back. But then she said that she was able to chew through the zip ties. So if the zip ties are behind her back, how does she get them to the front to
chew on them? Yeah. But you said she is small, though, because she'd do, like, down under her butt and back around.
You know, we talked about this in a former episode.
Yeah.
And I've only known a couple of people who could do it. They were women. They were also crackheads, so they were very, very tiny. I don't know if she was small enough to be able to slide them in front of her. Also, if Sherry's captors are allowing her to take showers, why would they not also be willing to take her to the bathroom? Like, why are they making her use a bucket?
Unless she just showers less often than she has to use the bathroom.
True, but if you're willing to move her, why not? I mean, do you really want to scoop urine and human feces out of, like, a 5-gallon litter box bucket thing?
I think that if you're taking her to the shower, you're taking her shower, like, what? Like, once a day at most, taking her to shower? But she can use the bathroom in the shower, I guess. But if you give her a bucket, she can go whenever she wants. If you don't give her a bucket, she's still going to go whenever she wants. But then you got to, like, clean it up out of the floor.
That's true.
I would rather clean it up out of a bucket of cat litter than the floor.
I think if you're willing to move her through the house, you just tell her you get to use the bathroom twice a day. She's going to learn to hold it. So you take her to the toilet twice a day. And then you have to clean up anything.
I could not hold it. I could not hold it.
Well, that's what you get for having baby. All right. Well, let's not forget about the discrepancies in her story regarding the branding. So in one of her later interviews...
I have not forgotten the branding.
Yes. One of the later interviews with police, this story about the branding keeps changing. So at first, she said it was a punishment for trying to escape. And then it was punishment for making too much noise, and then she said that it was actually a demand laid out by her buyer. So during their interview, Liz Thompson pointed out to Keith Morissette how interesting it was to her that the branding on Sherry's shoulder said Exodus.
Exodus, like the Bible?
Yes, like the book in the Bible.
I was going to make a joke about I was going to say something, but it's an inside joke between me and David, so you wouldn't have known what it meant, so I had to stop.
You going to let me in on the joke?
The Bible.
No.
He said Biblia, what is it, Bibliotheca or whatever Bibliotheca. Library is in Spanish.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said that one day on our way in church. He's like, I got to get my, he said Bibliotheca. He's like, I got to go get my Bibliotheca. And I'm like, that's not Bible.
Yeah.
And he was like, yes, it is. I'm like, nope, that's definitely library. And he's like, no. So then he Googled it and I was right. And now that's what he says all the time for Bible.
On purpose,
that's
right.
What I went to say. And then I was like, she's not going to get that joke.
Well, I know what biblioteca means because I took Spanish. But I also know that it means library.
I took Spanish, too. And for some reason, that word stuck with me. Because as soon as he said it, I'm like, that's not Bible. That's library.
Because it's a fun
one. But he was
one.
Like, no, it's Bible. I'm like, no, it's not.
Men.
But anyway.
Anyway, so her shoulder said Exodus.
Okay, Pam.
And so this investigator, this lady, points out that this is really ironic because the book of Exodus is about the rescue and liberation of the Israelites from slavery. And this is what's branded into her shoulder.
That is weird.
Ironic, right? So things just aren't adding up here. Like, ends are not meeting. Sherry ends up sitting down with a sketch artist who attempts to recreate an image of Sherry's captors. And this sketch, of course, creates a fair amount of controversy around town. So basically, anytime someone would see a Hispanic woman even remotely matching the sketches, police were called or a tip was sent into the hotline. All right, so this is California that we're talking about.
Yeah.
California has a pretty high Hispanic population. Mm-hmm. And in a town with 180,000 people, because it's right there next to Mexico.
Good job.
Yeah, I know that one. Thank you. Did you see how she tries to trap me, you guys? Rude. Anyway, so tips are coming in left and right. And obviously, all of these Hispanic women that are being called in on this tip line or accosted by citizens of Redding, California, are not going to be her captors. Like, all of these women can't be responsible.
Where is Redding, California? Is it north or south?
I think it's like in the middle-ish or northern part.
I will look it up. Northern California. Yeah.
So it was a constant struggle to get information out of Sherry. And her story would vary slightly here and there. But there was one thing that never changed. And that was her description of the two Hispanic women who kidnapped her. Police had no reason to question this description until a tip came in about a post that was found. And the post was written in 2003, and it was titled, Keep Walking. It was about a white woman who was bullied by two Hispanic women because of her race, which is laughable. The post...
Yeah, I was just like, okay.
Right. The post, written like a short story, was riddled with zingers.
I think they got it backwards.
Right. It was riddled with zingers like, quote, a chief problem was that I was drug-free, white, and proud of my blood and heritage. End quote. Like, okay, lady, what are you implying here? But don't worry, it gets worse. It went on to read, being white is more than just being aware of my skin, but standing behind skinheads and having pride for my country.
Oh, no.
Yeah, the blog post had been written under the name Sherry Graff, which is Sherry's maiden name. And when confronted with this information, she claimed that she never wrote that blog and that someone else must have written it and signed her name. Likely story.
I'm sure.
She then hired an attorney to get those posts taken off of the internet. Okay,
why
Sherry.
Didn't she just delete them herself?
Because she never wrote them. They were written.
Right.
They were written under her name. She was not responsible. So, regardless of whether or not Sherry wrote that story, there were some pretty eerie parallels between that and the narrative that she gave about her own kidnapping. In fact, that would become pretty important on later in the investigation.
When was the blog post written?
Wrote in 2003. And this is 2016.
Okay.
So 13
and
years ago.
She got
ago.
Married in 2009.
Yeah.
So that was her name at the time.
Yeah.
See, I'm listening to you. I knew what year they got married.
I am a little surprised, honestly.
I am very distracted by my cat, but you know what? She just needs love.
Lock her in the closet.
If you think that would make her be quiet, all that would do is make her scream more and then knock all of my purses into the floor.
I'd be entertained. All right. Well, in early 2017, the crime lab returned results stating that touch DNA had been found on Sherry's clothing from the night she had been found. There were two samples found that did not belong to Sherry. One was pretty seriously degraded and was only a partial sample, so that meant that it could only be ran against the local database because the national database...
It was found where?
It was just touch DNA. So it was just found, like... Skin cells were found on her clothing that didn't belong to her.
On her clothing, okay.
Mm-hmm. So since the partial sample was so badly degraded, it didn't meet the criteria for being placed onto the national database, but it was able to be ran against the local database and didn't match. The other sample was much better and had been ran against CODIS, but unfortunately no match was found at the time. And, you know, given that CODIS is constantly updated, the lab was given instructions to check the sample against the system once a week. That's pretty frequent.
Is that something that has to be done manually, or is that, like, computerized?
It's computerized.
To check it weekly?
Yeah. You create the DNA profile. So, you can do like your DNA mapping. It's a whole process. I can show you a picture of what it looks like. But that profile basically is entered into the computer with like certain mapping. And then anything that comes close to that map is flagged.
I should know if someone had to like manually like have like a list of I have to check all of these today.
No, it's just put on like a list that is like automatically pinged once a week for checking kind of thing. So
like at my work, we tell people we're going to automatically charge their credit card once a week, but that automatic charge credit card is me. So I just didn't know if it was something like that or not.
Yeah. So despite no matches being made, they still gleaned some puzzling information from the sample. So one of the samples belonged to a woman, which was no surprise because two women kidnapped her, right? But the other sample, the one found on her underwear, so this was touch DNA from her underwear, it belonged to a man, which is odd considering that she was super adamant that she had never been raped or otherwise sexually assaulted in any way, shape, or form, and had continually stated that no men were involved in her abduction. So how does men's underwear...
It was the men at the factory who checked her underwear before packaging it.
At the factory? At the hospital?
No, the man at the factory where the underwear is made.
Oh, okay, okay. I got you.
Like the inspector?
Right, you know that's... saying? Yeah, that's a likely story that she would give, right?
That's happened before, I'm pretty sure.
I mean, maybe... The investigators on this case were very careful at how they handled any discrepancies in Sherry's story. For starters, if they came at her too harshly, she would shut down and refuse to speak with them. So they were pretty careful with her. But secondly, just a year earlier, another woman had been kidnapped in California and was returned home. The police in that case treated the kidnapping like it was a hoax and were completely off base in doing so. So this led to a big ordeal and obviously raised a stink. So the investigators in this case wanted to be 100% sure before they called Sherry's kidnapping a hoax as well. So they were like quadruple checking all of their facts. A year and a half after Sherry's kidnapping, police were, I mean, they were out of leads and they were out of ideas. But then the Golden State Killer was captured. Do you remember what they used to capture him, the Golden State Killer?
I don't remember.
So they used familial DNA that they got from website. Yeah. So basically, when you turn your DNA into these, what's the name of the most popular site?
Family like Ancestry.com or 23andMe or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you upload your DNA to those databases, they store your DNA profile so that if somebody else uploads DNA that's similar or matches yours, you know that you have a relative that maybe you didn't know you had before. So they had the Golden State Killer's DNA and they ran it to see, okay, well, does this DNA from all of these rapes and murders, does this murderer have family that uploaded their DNA to this database? And he did. And that's how they narrowed it down and were able to catch him. So Detectives Wallace and Jackson requested and were granted this same ability to run, you know, the DNA for familial DNA. And finally, 3 years and 4 months later, on March 19th of 2020, there was a hit on a family member of the DNA found on Sherry's underwear. This was huge for police as it would drastically narrow down their investigation. They knew what family to look in now. Police began to look into James Reyes, who was an amateur hockey goalie from Costa Mesa, California. And everyone who knew Reyes described
him. I'm pretty
sure
that Costa Mesa is where David's brother lives.
Oh, well, I went to Costa Maya.
Like 85% sure.
Yeah, very nice.
Well, Costa Mesa is California.
Yeah, but I went to Costa Maya, which is in Mexico. Anyway, so everyone they talked to about Reyes described him as like the world's nicest guy. P- police didn't want to, like, immediately confront Reyes. They kind of wanted to scope him out a little bit, see what he was about. So investigators end up deciding.
They knew for sure it was his DNA, or they just knew it was in his family and they thought it might be him?
They knew it was in his family and they had a really good reason to think that it might be him. Okay. So they end up collecting his trash and they gather DNA from a bottle, a green tea. It was green tea, in case you ask. A green tea bottle. And it was a perfect match.
I wasn't
match.
Going to, but thank you.
You're welcome. It's a perfect match to the DNA found on Sherry's underwear. They dig into Reyes's past, and they discover that he and Sherry were in a pretty serious relationship. And when they asked some of his family about it, some of them said that they thought that the pair might have been engaged for a short time. But that relationship ends in 2006. So
Costa Mesa's like South California,
yes,
though.
Very Southern California.
And that other place is way North California.
Yep. They were doing some serious investigating here. So 10 years later.
That's a lot of. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if the investigators themselves went down there to collect his trash or if they had someone from
Well, I just mean if they're having a relationship, like California is not a small state.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
To be having north to south relationship.
Quite the hike. But so here we are 10 years later after their relationship ends. And he suddenly reappears in Sherry's life. I mean, that's strange. So Wallace and Jackson do end up approaching Reyes at his apartment. They do a cold knock, they said. Trying to catch him off guard,
basically.
I don't
like the way that sounds.
A cold knock. Yeah.
A cold knock.
I know. I didn't list it in my transcript like that because that term is weird. But
it sounds gross.
So they try and catch him off guard. And of course, he was super shocked and very confused as to why there were police on his doorstep. He said that he hadn't seen or heard from Sherry in many, many years. But after some prodding, he eventually starts talking. And he said that he was deep cleaning his apartment sometime in September of 2015 when he randomly stumbles upon some of Sherry's belongings. So he packed them up and he sent them to her, or to her mom's house, I think, actually. But inevitably, this got the two speaking to one another again. He said that she was the first to contact him. And after talking for a short while, she told him that she was in big trouble. She told Reyes that her husband, Keith, had been abusive towards her and that she needed his help getting out of a bad marriage. She said that if he was going to help her, that the two of them would need to talk in secret because if her husband found out, she'd be in big trouble. So, of course, she tells him to get a burner phone and acquires one of her own for them to communicate with. She then mailed him a point-by-point...
Why does he need a burner phone?
So that it couldn't be traced back to him. Like, she wanted them to talk in complete secret. That phone couldn't be traced to her. His phone couldn't be traced to him. There's no way that anybody would be able to tell that the two were talking to one another. Mm-hmm. Except they could. I'll tell you that in a minute. So she mails him a point-by-point list of instructions for him to follow on how he's going to come rescue her. She told him to have a friend rent a car that he could use. And that's what he was going to use to drive the 600 plus miles to Redding, California from where he was. So he drove
Sorry, girl, you're on your own. You don't have any friends that are closer?
Right. But he drove all day and night to get to her and then had breakfast at Trader Joe's, where he proceeded to a Starbucks and sat there until he received that text message from Sherry telling him what to do next. After receiving word from Sherry, he told investigators that he was told to pick her up and that she laid flat in the backseat of his car for basically the entire drive to Costa Mesa and barely said a word the entire time.
Long drive.
Yes. It's like 10 hours. If I remember, things were pretty normal at first, Reyes said. And Sherry settled into his apartment. He went to work like normal. But then he returned home one day and she had completely transformed his apartment. It was spotless. So it went from like a bachelor pad to this like spotless place where two people are supposed to live. And she had like rearranged a bunch of furniture and she set herself up in like a specific area of a room, which he did help her move the furniture around into that room, but like set herself up in there. And he said that she slept in his bed while he slept on the couch and that their relationship was in no way romantic. He thought he was helping out a friend who had been abused, and that was it. Okay, if I'm driving 1,200 miles round trip, renting a car, driving all day, that's 20 hours in all, you better be more than just my friend, lady.
You better be putting out.
I mean, that is not what I said.
That's what you said. Ass, gas, or cash. I don't remember what it is.
No.
What is it? Ass, gas, or grass.
Yes.
Ass, gas, or grass.
Yes, that's what it was.
That's what it is.
Well. So he said that he told his friends and family to keep their distance for a short while. And then Sherry was following the news about her own disappearance on her burner phone. So he like basically kept everyone at a distance. Burner phone. Yeah, I think they kept showing images of her burner as being an iPhone.
I guess you can get burner like smartphones, but in my mind, when I hear burner, I think like an old flip phone.
Yeah, 100%. So they would show his burner as a flip, but then they would occasionally show their burners as being iPhones. So I don't really know. But Rhea stated that he was living week by week, seeing how things would unfold with Sherry. And he told police that he had come home from work one day and she had cut off all of her own hair and that despite him cooking meals for them practically every night, she had put herself on like prison type rations. She had also smashed her own face into the shower wall and then threw herself onto the bathroom floor, creating several bruises all over crazy. Her body. Right? But just wait for what she did next.
Bitches be crazy.
She, according to him, did some very strange things. She asked him to hit her, and when he refused to put hands on her, they developed a plan in which she would stand like some distance away, and Reyes would shoot hockey pucks at her, causing severe bruises, especially to her shins. So he just kept shooting pucks into her shins. Then Sherry requested that he hit her with a hockey stick since, you know, he seemed okay with using tools to harm her, just not his own hands. But
at that point, he probably enjoyed shooting hockey pucks at her.
I mean, maybe. But he refused to do it. He refused to hit her with the stick. So she did convince him to just basically like hold the stick out and keep it still. And then she ran face first.
So she can run into it?
Yes. And this caused bruising to her face and damaged her nose. I'm not sure the extent, but I do know that it caused damage to her nose. Keith Morissette asked the detectives.
She's committed.
For real. He asked the detectives if they've ever heard of something like this before. And Sergeant Wallace said, no, I've never heard of anyone doing this. Not even kind of. Like, quote, not even kind of. He's never heard of anyone doing anything remotely close to this.
You've heard of Purple?
I can't continue talking
it's
like that.
It's called Gone Girl. It's a book. You should read it. There's also a movie with Ben Affleck.
I told you it would give you Gone Girl vibes. So in regards to the brand, Rhea said that Sherry gave him instructions to go by a Hobby Lobby and find wood burning or like a wood carving kit. She then laid down on the table, tightened her back, and would hand him piece by piece what she wanted him to burn into her skin, which was...
Exodus.
Now that you know.
Why did he agree to do that?
I see, that's my thing. I'm like, dude, How did she convince you to do all of this? Because no sane person would ask for that, but it would also take a pretty unhinged person to do it. Yeah. Yeah, there was no, like...
doing all of that.
There's a phrase that people use for that, and I'm not going to use it because it's vulgar. But, like, there was less incentive than what I would need to do some crazy stuff like that. But apparently, he said he had no idea what he was branding onto her shoulder until it was all said and done. Well, he didn't know beforehand. And he didn't realize what it was going to say because he didn't know when she would want him to stop branding. He didn't know until the end what it was going to say. He said that he woke up one day and Sherry told him that she missed her kids and wanted to go home. So just like that, he drove until she said to pull over and then he left her. Along the way...
He didn't see the missing story? The missing whatever?
I think she told him that, like, my husband is saying I'm missing because I left him and he wants me back because he controls me, he abuses me.
I guess that makes sense.
So I wonder if maybe he thought that he was making her look really bruised up so that she could go to the police about the abuse finally, but that maybe the police wouldn't believe her if she didn't look harmed.
What about whenever she got back and he didn't see the news stories that were coming out about this horrible
thing. Oh, afterwards, I'm sure he did. Yeah.
Yeah, so why didn't he go to police and be like, that didn't happen to her. This is what happened. They had to hunt him down.
He probably thought he would get in trouble because he's the one that did it to her. But anyway, so along the way, she discards her burner phone, some clothes, and any of the other items that could tie her to where she had been kept. The last item on her agenda, because she wasn't done, was to bind herself using the chain and zip ties, like I told you guys about earlier. And then next thing you know, Allison Sutton pulls over and, of course, calls 911. Reyes drives back home, attends Thanksgiving dinner with his family, and according to him, the two never communicated again after that day. And, I mean, there
he's
were...
He's like, well, that was weird.
Right. Well, there were no signs, like, police couldn't find any signs where they had tried to communicate, which, I mean, I guess they could have used another burner phone, but. So there we have it. There had been no abduction, no abuse, no plot, no Latina women. So what drove Sherry to do this, and which of the two were really in charge of this
She's
fake
crazy.
Kidnapping? Yeah. And what was the next step for police going to be? Because, I mean, running away is not a crime. What, if anything, were they going to charge her with?
No, but all of this, like, making the police go through all this effort and stuff. Be, like, false reporting, right?
She never...
Wasting police, I can't think of the word.
Resources. Yeah, so that'll come up again in a bit. Investigators Wallace and Jackson set out to corroborate the new information Reyes had given them. They spoke with a cousin of Reyes who confirmed that he had seen Sherry during the time of her disappearance. So he had come to his cousin's apartment. Boom, Sherry's there. So, like, they have someone saying that, yes, she has been there. The details of Sherry's injuries had never been made public, but Reyes seemed to be able to outline each one of them. And what's more is that Sherry had given police drawings and diagrams of the space she had been kept in, and... while they searched Reyes' apartment, it matched exactly. They even found the pole that she claimed to have been attached to in his closet. She had for sure been present in Reyes' apartment, but was his version the whole truth? Had he actually kidnapped Sherry and maybe she was just too scared to give the real identity of the person responsible? Police said when they interviewed Sherry, she basically sat there frozen the whole time. In August of 2020, after doing some more footwork, police interview her again for like the 800th time. And they didn't say that they knew who had abducted her. You know, they ask her again, tell me who, you know, who's responsible for this. But she continued to insist that two women were responsible. So finally, they're like, okay, no, we know James Reyes is involved in this. And she insisted that they were wrong. Like, she was not going to budge. She stuck to her story. But they even showed her pictures.
His DNA was on your underwear.
Right.
Your pictures match his apartment.
Yeah, no, he didn't.
He
like,
can
she...
describe. He can give wrong. Excuses for all of your everything.
You're wrong.
All of your wounds.
But they even showed her pictures of his apartment and still nothing. She kept dismissing the information they presented to her.
She's gaslighting the police officers?
Yes. Apparently, at one point, she described a hole in the wall of the closet. And what would you know? Reyes had the exact same hole in the exact same location in his closet. You know, naturally, the FBI had long since been called in on this case and was conducting their own interviews with Sherry. And after growing exhausted with Sherry's denials, they informed her that, hey, lying to federal agents is a crime. And this pretty much just caused her to shut down again. But according to court documents, once her husband left the room, Sherry did speak a little bit, and she admitted that she had talked to an ex-boyfriend, Reyes, before the kidnapping. And she also said that she made a mistake and talked to some other men that she shouldn't have. And then she followed it with, "I am horrible." Because that's the part of this story that she's horrible for. She right. wouldn't say anything else about the kidnapping. She only wanted to talk about some flirtation and some possible promiscuity with these men. Keith Morissette asked the prosecutor on the case, you know, at what point, if any, did she cross the line into criminality? Which, you know, good question, Keith. Thank you. The prosecutor told him that lying to the FBI is prosecutable, which opened the avenue for charges to be pressed. So now, 5.5 years after first making headlines, Sherry Papini is in the papers yet again. And on March 3rd, 2020, Sherry had driven her children to a piano lesson, and she was like waiting inside while they're doing their thing. And she was approached by a woman who had announced that someone's car had been hit out in the parking lot, and it turns out that it was Sherry's car. That woman was actually an FBI agent, and she followed Sherry outside, and then she, along with several other agents, placed Sherry under arrest. She was charged with lying to a federal agent, along with 34 counts of mail fraud, which
oh, wow.
reminds me of Al Capone, who ended up being apprehended for tax evasion.
Yeah.
And not the actual crimes that he committed.
I mean, whatever it takes.
I mean, it's crafty for sure. So apparently she had received more than $30,000 from the California Victims Compensation Fund, which she had been receiving checks from via the mail, hence the mail fraud charges. So at 39 nice. Years old, Sherry was finally facing justice. The community was really railing against the news of her arrest. They felt betrayed, and they were sickened by the fact that she took money away from real victims and was able to benefit from her lies. That's $30,000 from California, and then remember the $49,000 from the GoFundMe.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at almost $80,000 at this point. Her family released a statement that read, "We love Sherry and are appalled by the way in which law enforcement ambushed her in a dramatic and unnecessary manner in front of her children." So her children were present inside for their piano lessons, but apparently they like snatched her up and put cuffs on her super quick, and like she was caught off guard and like almost fell to the ground, I think. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But they were just appalled by the manner in which she was arrested.
I don't like when they do stuff like that in front of the kids.
Well, they didn't. Like I said, they were inside
the
at their piano lesson. I did think about that, and I have no idea. I'm sure at this point, Keith was in on it. Because by now, yeah. after... So when...
Or if not, they called him. It was like, hey, we just arrested your wife. You need to come get your kids.
He was present for a lot of her interviews. And after the FBI confronted her about her lies, he, like, became really upset and left the interview room. And then apparently they separated not long after that.
Mm.
So he realized that
she might have been in on it.
Had been lying, and was like, okay, bye. Her public defender, Mary Ackridge, thought that police should have given Sherry the chance to turn herself in. She pointed out that, you know, Sherry came in for all of these interviews. So if you told her that you wanted to arrest her, she probably would have just come to you. You didn't have to create this ruse.
Why does it matter, though? It doesn't matter in the end.
No. She said that the FBI basically wanted her to do a perp walk, which, I mean, they may have wanted to because they spent 5.5 years investigating this bogus case. But either way, there was going to be a show out of her arrest anyway. You know?
Yeah.
5 days after her arrest, a federal judge had Sherry released on a $120,000 bail, which sounds like a lot, but you only pay 10% of that. And so that's like no money at all. But she had to agree to undergo psychiatric treatment and give up her passport. And I'm sure you're all burning to know if James Reyes was ever charged. And the simple answer is no. Because basically, he never committed a crime. He was simply doing what his friend asked of him. She asked to be hit and asked to be branded. She cut off her own hair. She starved herself. What did he really do that she didn't want him to do? The answer is nothing.
Right.
So he was never charged. He is currently staying with family in Arizona, but when Dateline went to his house to request an interview, he refused to speak with anyone. As far as Keith Papini is concerned, are there charges against him as well? After Sherry's return, Keith took almost $32,000 from the GoFundMe account and put it into his personal checking account. There was a big stink about that and about how the couple had used the GoFundMe money to pay off credit card debt and some other personal expenses. So a lot of people theorized that maybe he knew that it was a hoax and that he started the GoFundMe just to make money from all of it. And they didn't think that he should have used any of that money. So they wanted charges pressed against him, basically.
The thing is, though, I don't think he knew about it. And I think that once you give people that money, they can use it however they need to use it during a time that they need to use it. However, by time he found out, like, it was too late to give that money. He doesn't have that money anymore to give it back.
Yeah.
If he found out within, like, 3 days what happened, then, yeah, I think you would have to give the money back. But in 5 years,
the money was long gone. Given to him to help him with his search efforts. It was given to him to help, you know, like, say he needs to take off work for a couple of weeks to help look, to take care of the kids, to deal with his own grief, whatever. That money was given to them to help sustain him.
To use how he needed to use it.
Yeah. So I don't think that it should have been weird that he moved it to his checking account. Of course he's going to move it to his checking account so that he can use it.
How else are you going to use it?
Right. So now detectives have to reevaluate how much Keith knew and what his participation, if any, was in all of this. Detectives Wallace and Jackson recounted to Keith Morissette the reaction that Sherry's husband had while they showed Sherry the pictures of Rhea's apartment. And according to them, they said he was practically vibrating with excitement. And they think that he was genuinely excited because they thought that he had found the location where Sherry had been kept captive, which means that they could solve this case.
Yeah.
They would know who kidnapped her. Then they recounted the reaction he had when they confronted Sherry about her lies. And they said that he, like, there was no way, given his reaction, that he had any clue what was really going on. And that he became super upset and had to leave the room, like I said earlier. And then he filed for a separation. During the trial, Sherry's defense attorney had planned to focus on how Sherry must have been mentally ill. Because how else would someone, you know, why else would someone do something like this?
Super manipulative.
Yeah. And that they should be focusing on her mental illness and not on getting revenge for her supposed lies. She said that Sherry had a fictitious disorder, which is where someone basically makes stuff up and then convinces themselves that it's true.
Yeah.
The sheriff at the time, he's currently still the sheriff, I believe, since this was just in 2020. But the sheriff, Michael Johnson, said that he looks at it from a bit of a different angle. So while few would claim that she did nothing wrong, the sheriff pointed out that they spent over $150,000 investigating her case. Yeah. That's a lot of money. Especially, mm-hmm. like, police don't have a lot of money. Police departments are not given a lot of money. Period. Otherwise, they would pay us more. And I'm telling you right now, they don't. So, her attorney said that disappearing was not a crime and that it was police who chose to keep using their resources to investigate what happened to Sherry after she was returned. Which, that's a big load of bullshit, because you still have to find out who kidnapped her. Like, oh, she's returned, no harm done. No, that's not how that works. But that's basically what she was saying. Like, you chose to keep spending that money to investigate when she was returned home. That's your fault that you spent that. Lady.
Yeah, that's not how that works.
Shut up. Right. She also said that, she said something about they only were willing to use that much in resources because they all were caught under the missing white woman syndrome. And mm-hmm. that's why they put so much effort into the investigation. Otherwise, when the leads went cold, they would have stopped looking. Which is not really
true. I don't disagree with that, but still.
Well,
I don't think that they would have put as much effort into it had they not had the pressure of the media.
Right. But that's from media pressure. I think that police put the same amount of effort and energy into every case, especially if leads are still coming in. But when you get the media that blows you up about something, do you really think they're going to let you stop looking and get away with it? You know, like, they're not going to let the case go cold for you. So that's not necessarily the police's fault that they experience media pressure. It's the media, and it's like a systemic issue. It's not a police issue. You know what I'm saying?
I get it.
Yeah. Anyway, the sheriff said that that was a diversion tactic that her defense attorney was using to distract from the fact that much time, money, and energy was spent not just on the part of the police, but on part of the whole community of Reading. So all of these strangers came to her aid, and she abused their willingness to help her. So her attorney also pointed out that someone doesn't spend so much time in therapy if they aren't ill, and that, you know, she had to have been benefiting from the sessions because she needed them. Her therapist also diagnosed her with PTSD, so that has to count for something, right? Well, the sheriff said that she may have needed therapy because obviously she has some issues she needs to work for, but that she shouldn't have been using the money that she got from the victim's fund to pay for it, because in the end, she was cheating the system to get that money in the first place.
She had reasons to be in therapy before she had that money.
For sure, but she should have used her money to pay for it.
Wouldn't have done the thing she did.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
She wouldn't have done the thing she did.
So, and then Sherry's attorney had the audacity to say that, you know, maybe she didn't even know that she was lying. Maybe she had convinced herself that these things were true, or maybe she was just trying to get something she needed from her story. So she needed attention, or she needed someone to take care of her. And obviously she needed those things so badly that she was willing to go through whatever extent it took to get it. And that she...
It sounds like she's needed it her whole life based off all the other stuff you said.
Right. But she had convinced herself that she was telling the truth about her abduction.
I mean, that happens. But I don't think that happened here.
No. 5 weeks after her arrest, Sherry took a plea deal from the federal prosecutors, and she issued a formal statement apologizing for what she had done. She said, "I am deeply ashamed of myself for my behavior and so very sorry for the pain I've caused my family and friends and all the good people who needlessly suffered because of my story." Keith Papini is filing for divorce, and he said that it was because his wife was not acting in a rational manner. He said that his wife had lied to their children about her disappearance. And, quote, "The fact that their mother lied to them on such a major issue is something they and I are having a hard time dealing with. We, both children and I, need time to recover and stabilize." She hasn't seen her children since April 4th of this year and has missed scheduled visitation times before he ended up asking the court to, quote, "Help me protect my children from the negative impact of their mother's notoriety." So, according to the divorce petition, they had been married since October of 2009, which we know, but they separated on March 3rd, and that was the day that she was arrested for federal charges. So, he filed, like, official separation papers with the state of California.
Yeah.
Keith and the children are currently staying with relatives in Chico, California, which is about 75 miles of where they lived at the time that all this went down. Keith was actually scheduled to address the media about his custody issues after his court hearing that was on May 9th of this year. So this article came out yesterday at the time of recording. So she faced a maximum sentence of up to 25 years in prison and ended up with $500,000 in fines, and she will be officially sentenced on July 11th.
Oh, so you have to give us an update.
Yes, I will have to give an update. Oh, sorry, you guys. I know that was a really long case, but there was a lot going on there. But yeah, that is the bogus kidnapping of Sherry Papini.
I liked it. That was fun.
Well, I'm glad I kept you captivated. I know it was a long ride. Huh?
Yeah, now I'm tired. I want to go to bed.
That's all we have for you today, listeners.
Make sure to follow us on social media. We have Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, all at TCKSPod. That's TCKS as in two can keep a secret.
And stick around for the end of the episode where we have some bloopers for you.
And again, thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Start the recording with you coughing.
There's some great emo songs that start with a cough.
That's true. So. I got your picture. Yep. I'm going with you.
I'm actually going to need you to stop because I can't hear you over this chaos. Do you hear this?
Yes, of course I hear it.
She's screaming at the door. They're freaking out. It's so exciting.
Oh, yes.
It's like a farm.
There was another
report.
Sorry,
I was muted, and I didn't realize I was muted. I don't know what I said now, but
it wasn't important.
I said something.
Probably more griping at me because I won't tell you what the brand says.
So.
Hi, Mazikeen.
Mace.
This is the loudest I've heard her meow in a long time. When
I guess, hold on one second.
She muted it, and she's screaming at the cat, and I can't see her, or I can see her, but I can't tell what she's saying. But Mace is getting a very serious lecture right now.
Anyway,
it worked, because she's quiet.
Not really. She's just chirping instead of screaming. She never does that. I don't know why she started doing that.
I don't know. I look up at Pam and her cat's sitting on her shoulder. She's got a Kleenex stuffed up her nose.
Well, I was trying to, like, get my snot, my nose was running, and she jumped up on me, so I had to leave it dangling. Ugh. That time, she actually dug into my back.
Mm. Mace.
That's not something she does. Like, she doesn't walk on us like that, on our backs and everything, so I don't know why she's done it to me twice now.
Mace. Do you remember my dad's cat used to do that?
Mace.
So if you, like, squatted down and patted your shoulder, she would, like, climb up you. And, like, perch on your shoulder like a parrot.
She doesn't do that. I don't know why she keeps doing it. But I thought I was going to have to go yell for David to come get her off of me.
Help me.